Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 815. This episode is brought to you by the Nerdist Community Corkboard, reminding you that you, the Nerdist community, can submit things to the corkboard at events at nerdist.com. Do it, and you might hear Kyle the Walk-Around Muppet say...
It's just weird watching you like wrestle with like the different voices in your head.
You know,
different announcer voices are all coming out at the same time.
Why didn't you just go into the corkboard thing? Why'd you go?
Because
meta?
I wanted to do it on my terms. And the terms of a new generation,
old
man.
I didn't mean to marginalize. Marginalize your role on the show.
As I now promote a Game of Thrones musical.
What?
If you live in the Chicago area from July 21st to August 21st, they're doing Thrones, the Game of Thrones musical at the Apollo Theater. I would for sure pay money to go watch this.
Cersei, where can I run to?
I like that you've assumed that, like all modern Broadway musicals, it's just 80s songs
it's
with
80s
new lyrics.
It's 80s covers with character names.
I just hope it has lots and lots of...
Tyrion Lannister and the road.
You do those too easy.
Travel.
Like I don't. Either those were already in the chamber, which
no.
makes me even more upset.
They were not already in the chamber. It's At Midnight has trained me. Hashtag Wars has soiled my brain.
It has taken you to some new and crazy places.
Game of Thrones music. Game of Thrones songs. Hashtag Game of Thrones songs.
All I know about Hashtag Wars is occasionally somebody thinks, oh, I'm going to do a Kyle Clark is rad deep cut. And I'm like, you know what's not going to win you the Hashtag War? Me.
All right,
like,
so
they'll pop up about once a month. I'm like, oh, somebody thinks this is a fun thing to do.
Hodor line. Love isn't always on time.
Oh.
All
right, they go so like natural.
Right.
You don't even look excited. You're just like, yep, nope, this is inside me.
Does it hurt when they come out? Every time.
Do we have any other sponsors besides the corkboard?
Yeah, there's a sponsor.
I got something for the corkboard.
Oh, I'm going back to the Wilbur Theater in Boston in November.
Ooh.
So if you go to id10t.com, that's good news to get good news. If you go to id10t.com, you can get tickets there. We're going to do a couple shows at the Wilbur in Boston in November. There you go, Katie Levine.
All right, so there's a play in L.A. called Four Chords and a Gun.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about this.
Katie and I are going to
Arden
this.
Marine's in it. John Russ Bowie's in it. It's at the Bootleg Theater in L.A., and you can find tickets by going to bootlegtheater.com, but it's all about the Ramones.
Yeah, it's about the Ramones early on in New York City, and it's a whole play about that.
It sounds really cool. It's a musical. Definitely go check it out.
Great. This episode is David Schwimmer. He's promoting Feed the Beast Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Feed the Beast!
On a channel called AMC.
AMC!
AMC! I'm going to do it like the old Howard Stern WNBC.
Oh, there we go.
AMC!
It sounds like it's like Bob Dylan trying to put it into a lyric.
AMC! All right, no one's going to listen to that for more than a line. This episode is podcast number 815 with Mr. David Schwimmer.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
From 1978, and I said, "My
is that really the first one you had."
Yeah,
I think I had that Apple, like one of the first Mac. You know,
like the original Macintosh.
Yeah, the original Macintosh. That was my first computer.
They were great.
I think I'm a little older than you.
I don't think by much, actually. I think we're in the same
ballpark.
We're in the same ballpark. I think you might be. Mm. I think you might have me by a couple of years.
I'm 49.
So. I'm 44.
Oh, see.
See, we're in the same. We're in the same general region.
We have some of
region.
The same references.
How's it going?
This is Ina.
I know Ina very well. Yes.
Ina and I went to elementary school together.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Fourth grade. Or earlier. Second. Yeah.
Was this in New York or out here?
No, out here.
So you, because you were born in New York.
I was born in New York, but grew up out here and then moved, and then Chicago and now.
And you're from here? It's so odd to meet someone who's locally grown, locally sourced, organic Los Angeles material. It's so rare. People always migrate or we're shipped in.
Yeah.
But you pretty much were a Los Angelino.
Pretty much, yeah. Although my parents are real New Yorkers, so it was I don't know. I had this strange kind of upbringing I had this hybrid accent for a while because my mom has a really thick New York accent. My dad doesn't, even though he's from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think I grew up kind of a mutt in that way. But.
did they try to force New York stuff on you? Like, you are not going to forget your roots. I don't care that we're out
Well,
here.
Yeah. And not only that, all my grandparents were all in New York, all my aunts and uncles. You know, my parents really pursued job opportunities out here in the late 60s. So we would go back at least twice a year to New York. So just to, you know, stay in touch with all the relatives and also to see – my mom was big into theater, so we would, you know, see in a week we'd see like six shows in a week that we'd be in New York. So,
what was the theater? Because LA has theater. There are theaters here.
There are some theatres, but I don't think anyone would ever accuse Los Angeles of being like, oh, it's a theater town.
No, I think that's safe to say. I don't know. I mean, there is a theater scene here. Certainly, there was, you know, when I was based here more, I did some little theater, what would be the equivalent of off Broadway
right
here. I don't know. I'm more familiar, truthfully, with Chicago theater.
Right.
And I guess growing up, my parents took me to Broadway and off Broadway.
Was that your theater company was in Chicago? Is that the one you founded was in Chicago?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, Chicago is such a great – Chicago is an amazing comedy town, but it's also a good theater town.
Great theater and art and music and restaurants now. I mean, it's one of the top. Culturally, it's one of the best cities in the country now.
I guess because it's so fucking cold a lot of the time. It's like, we'll go inside and watch.
Everyone's indoors making stuff because there's no way they're going to be outdoors. It's the antithesis to California where everyone's outdoors.
Right. So that's why there's no theater culture. Because it's not really like a – I mean, it's like
well,
music
also,
too.
Think about it. Like, and this is the problem we have in Chicago still. It's like when the weather is great – Your business hurts as a theater company because no one wants to be indoors for a 2 o'clock matinee on a Saturday.
Right.
Like no one. So it's really bad for business when the weather's good. So that's why, in a way, California, I mean, it's a struggle. You know, it's a struggle, I think, here because the weather is so nice so much of the time.
And I think there's also so much focus on the entertainment business, too, the theater business.
That's the other thing. This doesn't happen in Chicago where you cast a play and then, sorry, I got a pilot. Guys.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know, people just bail here. Like you start rehearsing a play here, you know, and a lot of actors, they don't even care. I mean, they care to a degree, but not as much as, you know, as their careers. You know, they'll just drop on a dime for a great gig.
Yeah.
So the whole – then you have to recast or have an understudy go on. And it's hard to – it's certainly hard to do ensemble theater.
That is definitely the understanding. That is the kind of unspoken agreement if you're an actor in Los Angeles and you go like, yeah, we can make plans. But if I get an audition,
exactly right.
I'm going to bail.
Same thing. Yeah. No, I'll do the play. But
yeah.
If I get a guest spot, if I get it on CSI.
Yeah, if I have CSI or I'm a churro vendor in an episode of The Flash, I got to go to Canada. I'm sorry. Good luck with your play. Yeah, it's just not the main – it's just not really the main industry here. Yeah. But there's so much there's so much prestige to theater. But in L.A., I think people just don't really – it's kind of a bummer. They don't really take it that seriously. It's like, yeah, that's cute.
Right.
This is really, you know.
Right. You're right. I think you're right. It's
Did you struggle with that when you became, when Friends hit and then you were really like a TV guy? Did you feel like, well, I have to extra responsibility to make sure that I can still be a theater guy too?
Yeah, for sure. But again, because I was part of a company and they were my closest friends as well, they actually helped keep me sane during all that craziness. And I would go back as much as I can to do theater in Chicago on my breaks from the show, either direct or act in a play. And that would keep me kind of grounded and keep my head level.
That's amazing. Kyle, you have to stop typing. It sounds like a call center.
That's right.
I'm going to have to escalate this.
Speaking of, you know, I'm familiar with call centers. That was my first job, actually, before I was out of high school. I sold copy machine toner and developer in this place in the summer before college to make a little extra money. And you had to start at I had to get there at 6 a.m. because our first calls were on the East Coast. You know, you would have pages and pages of leads, and you'd get some you didn't get the receptionist at some place or some you'd ask for, like, who handles your supplies, your toner and printer supplies, your copy machines. So, hold on one second. I guess I do. And then you'd have to, like, try to con them and sell them and pretend you were their rep.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, hey, I'm here calling about your Canon, and you would know exactly what machine they had.
Oh.
So you'd say, yeah, I'm calling. It looks like you need more developer.
How did you get that information?
Dude, I don't know how they got this shit, but they had all this stuff. So, and I was the youngest person there by 30 years, yeah, easily, right? I'm 17, okay? And one day, like 3 months into the job, and I mean, there are some seasoned pros there, and I'm making okay money. But one day I show up, the whole place is boarded up.
Oh, shit.
They were raided and shut down. And I was like, I guess I'm out of a job.
Were you good at it?
No, I was not good at it. I mean, it's really – I mean, I guess it was using some acting skills, but I don't know. I felt really dirty doing it because it was – just a straight up con.
Were you actually selling that? You were actually selling toner? There wasn't any. Okay.
No, we were selling.
So it wasn't
supplies
a scam.
That they didn't need.
Right, of course.
Right? So the whole thing was, and pretending to be their local supplier or that I was their copy machine rep.
Did you ever say you were their copy machine rep, or you just talked
No, you couldn't. Legally, you couldn't say it.
Right.
But you spoke as, oh, yeah, I'm looking here. It looks like your Canon XR50 needs you're short on developer. I'm going to send you this. We got a special right now. Just keep talking, you know, until they say, oh, okay, yeah. So I'm sending this to, and I knew the address, I knew the business, I knew all that stuff. All right, Doris, I'm glad to talk to you. This is on its way, should be with you soon. Thank you, you know, I'll check back in with you. You know, we never check back in. You know, it was just this con. But, you know.
Cadillacs are for closers.
That's why they got raided.
Because it got super – I mean, that is – I mean, it's not a – I don't know, though. Maybe there was something more illegal going on that you weren't aware of.
It's possible, man.
Because that sounds...
No, the whole place was shady. I mean, it wasn't... Like, the whole thing, it was like on a corner at, like, near the freeway and Robertson. You know, it was...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was dicey.
Yeah.
And that was back then.
Yeah,
the area
yeah,
was
yeah.
even more dicey.
Yeah, that was a lower Culver City back then. Yeah, it was not a nice place.
It was lower... Culver City.
When the foodies came in, feed the beast. I mean, if we're just
what? We're what a transition, in, Chris. That was amazing.
I appreciate it. Yeah, Culver City used to. I mean, this is obviously people who aren't from here are going to have no references. Culver City used to be uninhabitable. There were a couple lots there. Sony was there, and then there was another Sony, right. And then Culver Studios.
Right.
And then everything else was just like, oh, when it's dark, don't go on the moors. Like, it was just a really desolate, creepy place.
Yeah.
And then all the food hipsters came in and design hipsters, and now there's furniture stores and food. But back
then,
dangerous place
to
be.
No man's land. The Wild West.
Yeah. And did you try different characters? Did you call
it? I tried, but I was 17.
Yeah.
My voice had barely, had just broken. So I don't think I could. I didn't. You know, I did what I could, but I had limited range at that point. So, but I tried. I would listen to the older guys and, you know, try to affect, you know, whatever they were doing. But I was not very good at it.
I think people with strong performing genes don't, even though to a degree as a performer, you are a salesman. I mean, you have to sell a concept or a character to an audience. But that whole, like, what's it going to take to get you? Like, I feel like most performers do not enjoy that. And that is partially why you probably go into performing, is to not have to do that every day.
Right.
Did you immediately go into another call sales position?
No. I mean, I went to college and then
Northwestern.
Northwestern. And, you know, my next, I mean, I waited tables for 7 years between Chicago and LA. And that's a form of salesmanship, you know, a form of performance. I became, you know, like, I had a character, I guess, as a waiter. I was this really semi-elegant, you know, very well-spoken professional. I don't know, it was, although in Chicago, my first waiting job, I was at a restaurant called Ed DeBevick's.
Oh, yeah, of course.
All right. So I was a roller skating waiter at Ed's.
But you had to have characters at Ed DeBevick's.
No, you had to be a character.
Yeah.
So I was Romeo. Everyone had the name tag, and I was Romeo, and I had the big pompadour, and we made all our money off tips, jumping over people's kids. You know, no, really. We would do stunts, and we would just jump over people. I think they shut that down because some kid caught a skate to the head or something.
Oh, yeah. I feel like that would be especially in today's litigious culture. That was a terrible idea.
Not a good call.
A terrible idea.
So we stopped doing that.
Well, there was an Ed DeBevick's here in L.A. Was that the one you worked at or the one in Chicago?
No, I didn't know there was one here.
There was one by the Beverly Center for years, and it closed probably 15 years ago. But it was super... It was one of those, you know.
I worked at the Daily Grill at the Beverly Connection.
Ah, yes, of course, across from the Beverly Center.
I go back, right?
Oh, wow, that really does go back.
Yeah, it's not there anymore.
No, it's like either a phone store or it's something. But yeah, I knew that Daily Grill.
Well, that was me.
Oh my God, I can't believe it. Yeah, the Ed DeBevick's. I was always fascinated by the agreement that the patrons would have with the staff, which is. Yeah, we're going to go in and they're kind of probably going to treat us like shit. And that's really funny because some waitress will be like, slide over, sweetheart. And you're like, all right, can I just get a...
There was an agreement when you set foot that you were going to be abused. And it was a very sadomasochistic relationship. And we had permission to abuse people.
Yeah.
And that was fun.
That it makes me think of... I don't know if I talked about this in the podcast. One of the last times I was in New York, the soup Nazi guy... is now marketing his own soup, and they've rebranded him. There were banners of it all over the city. It's the most genius rebranding. Like, we want to sell soup. How do we get away from Nazi? So they call him Soup Man. He's the Soup Man, as seen on Seinfeld, the Soup Man. And he's like, there's like an American flag in the – like every piece of it was like – Let's forget about the Nazi part of it and just focus on the soup part of it. Right. They've completely rebranded him as the Soup Man.
Right. It's like the new KKK. Right. It's like they're
for a millennial generation.
We don't hate black people. No. We just really like us.
Yeah, I mean, we'll just the foreground of the selfies are mostly white faces. That's all we're saying. That's all we're saying. Because we have an Instagram account now.
The soup former Nazi.
The soup I was just following orders, man. Yeah, no, they really – and it was a really fascinating study of how, you know, this guy had a moment and it was this thing.
Yeah.
And everyone knew him as this thing, but it was attached to Seinfeld. So how do you get him away from Seinfeld and get him away from the Nazi party?
Right.
And it seems like they did it successfully.
That's interesting.
Because they were all over the city.
That's interesting. And because Seinfeld had accepted him as a Jewish comic, there was some kind of – it was acceptable.
Right.
It was palatable.
Well, because he wasn't a literal Nazi.
No, of course not.
It wasn't like the weird –
but I mean even the term, you know, it was digestible.
I find that what was acceptable on television in the 90s even is jokes you couldn't make now.
Not only that. What was acceptable – I would argue, in the 70s is not acceptable today.
No.
I mean, when you watch All in the Family.
Oh, yeah.
And what they said on that show and the issues they were tackling. I mean, the closest, at least in network television, seems to be, you know, the Carmichael Show. Like, they're at least addressing some issues of relevance with, you know, in a comedic way. But... I don't know if you saw like the Bill Cosby episode or
I did not see the Bill Cosby episode.
Yeah. Really interesting, you know, provocative. But I mean, the stuff going on and All in the Family, you couldn't get away with today.
Well, that was, you know, that Norman Lear movement was the backlash to the – or not a backlash necessarily, but, you know, all of those Happy Homemaker type sitcoms from the 50s
from
and
the 60s. From the 50s and 60s, right.
It was just that counterculture movement of like, no, the 70s are dirty and gritty and real and, you know, people have fucking problems, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then it all switched around in the 80s when everyone was doing coke in Wall Street.
That's right.
But where do you think, where does Friends fall into all that? Where do you think that...
Where does that feel like?
Well, a decade from 94 to 2004, right? Is that – I mean, it's the 90s for sure. I mean, if you look at our – in the pilot, if you look at our hairstyles and clothes, I mean, it's just hysterical.
Which really was a thing. Like every season, like what are they going to look like this year? Who's going to wear what?
That's right, and hairstyles.
What's the hairstyle? Right.
And now looking back on it, it's hysterical. I mean, to think that was actually that some of us are more like Jen and the ladies were setting trends. I don't think the boys ever set any style.
You guys
trends.
Did, though. Everyone did have a – and I'm sure at the time I was like, yeah, you know, this – This braided vest is an awesome idea. This sweater vest with the V-neck and the piping is like this is the, does oh, not the, get any cooler
Chandler
than this.
Vest, the
yeah,
Chandler,
yeah, the Chandler yeah, vest does not yeah, get maybe. Any cooler than this.
Man.
But it is it's a fun time capsule.
Yeah, I think now. But I read this New York Magazine article that came out like a month or two ago saying that because of Netflix and the ability to stream. The new generation, 14, 15-year-old kids, are really up on Friends. You know, they're watching it, and it's amazing to me that it's got that staying power today. And it makes me think that, well, of course, to them it's a world that they are mystified by. I mean, it's such an innocent world. The fact that there are six people on a couch and they actually are talking to each other. No, I'm serious. I think it's so foreign because we didn't have social media and texting or anything.
Right.
If you watch, 5, 15-year-olds sit on a couch today, none of them are talking to each other. No. They're all on their phones talking to other people. So I think in some way it's there's a bit of nostalgia – or not nostalgia, just fascination with – teenagers about like what
that's is it kind of like when
that's what it was like in
it
the
might
90s?
Have been like when we would watch like Bewitched or I Love Lucy
right.
Oh wow, black and white, that's crazy,
and look at how nicely dressed they are for dinner, or just whatever chores they're doing, they're dressed beautifully and perfectly.
Separate beds, right? Ricky and Lucy are sleeping in separate beds.
You know what, I think that has a lot to do with it. There's that big an age gap.
Yeah.
So
I think that was maybe so that Ricky could sneak in dancers from the Copa into the bathroom and not wake up Lucy. I think it was probably more along those lines.
Yeah.
This apparently was her dressing room, I'm told.
Right here.
This, yeah. The room. This is my dressing room, is through that door. And,
wow.
And this apparently, because this stage is the I Love Lucy, was the original I Love Lucy stage.
That's really cool.
I keep hoping that I'm just going to
find some lipsticks.
Some lipstick, just like the hacking cough of a ghost somewhere in the background. But it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
But I think also because kids, I think this generation does not sit down and watch television when it airs. So they're going to rifle through Netflix. Oh, hey. Oh, Friends. And at the core of it, it's still a great show. It's still six people interacting with problems that people have, just, in slightly different clothing.
Right.
At what point did the show – because the show really kind of became – it really was just a sitcom when it started. It was like, oh, it's a sitcom. It's six people. But then it really kind of became its own entity. Do you think that happened right away or did
it happen really quickly? I don't know why. I don't understand it. I think I thought at one point maybe it was because it was hitting a sweet spot in terms of a generation that was watching it who were growing up as products of divorce,
mm-hmm.
or just different kinds of families, and people were defining – I think people were that age were defining and choosing who their family was.
Right.
Because a lot of people were moving out of city or state to go to school or just – people were just moving around more and not staying at home. So when you move, you start to form your new family, your own family, and that's by your own choosing. And I think that had a lot to do with it, that it just – it was of the moment where people were starting to define or choose for themselves who their family was going to be.
Yeah, and also a time period where – like 30 million people could watch a show,
right.
And that was not a crazy thing.
That's right.
And now a network's like, oh, 2 million people watch our show. It's a huge hit. It's just like the audience, everything's so splintered.
It's crazy,
now.
Right?
Did it feel life-changing at the time?
Immediately.
Immediately.
Immediately. Yes, it was terrifying. I'm not kidding.
Why?
I was I because we were thrust into a kind of celebrity that I just had never experienced, none of us had experienced before. So, and I personally didn't respond well to it at the time. I was uncomfortable with it. And I didn't like being treated differently than, like I hadn't changed, but suddenly people would be treating me completely differently than I was accustomed to. And also, frankly, with a, I have a very strong sense of justice because of my parents and how I was raised, and they're both lawyers. And I just felt the way I was being treated was not just, it just wasn't right. And I, you know, I would, like the simple thing of going for a cup of coffee at the Starbucks line, and there's a line of, you know, eight people, you know, I'd take my place in line. And this happened early on, you know, so I really remember this moment. And, you know, one of the dudes behind the counter said, dude, you know, come here, you don't have to wait. You know, and that was a moment for me of like, no, I'm good right here. Because I just felt, how would I feel if I were that guy in front of me? Like, what's the deal? This guy walks up, you know, I mean, I just felt like it was totally wrong.
God, I'd be okay with that. I'd be too okay with
that. I'm not saying I've not accepted, you know,
of course, certain treatment sometimes.
And, you know, when I'm really dying to get into a restaurant and, you know, that helps, sure. But you know, there's just a balance, just trying to maintain a balance. I also remember, like, driving up to the lot one day and a woman and her daughter were kind of barely around the area where my parking spot is at the stage. And the guard, you know, who's just doing his job, but he was new, and he was like over – he saw me start to pull in, and he was like, you know, screaming at this woman and her daughter, just, please get out of the way, move over there. And I was just
good for him.
Oh, no, right. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. That was bad.
You know, I was just like, dude, just chill. It's all good, you know.
Were you guys a support group for each other at the same time?
Okay, yeah, for sure.
Because who else is experiencing that at the same time? Like, how are you talking about that with anyone?
Well, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, you experience your own celebrity, your own fame. Do you?
But not on the friend. I mean, like, friends is friend. Like, that was just one of those. There are a few things in our culture that kind of defined and were representative of the culture of the time. Right. So it's like, you know, you All in the Family or Happy Days or Seinfeld or Friends. Or, like, those were just the things that are MASH. Like, those were just the things that, in that period of time,
were help define pop culture.
Help define pop culture, for sure. And were just the, like, in the upper, the highest canopy level of everything. And so, yeah, I mean, when I'm out in public, we go, hey, I watch your show. I go, thanks. But it's not like, I mean, it's not the kind of rabid where I'm sure there were periods of time where you guys are like, I don't think we can go anywhere in public tonight.
That's what I mean by terrifying. Like, I'd be in the first couple of years just walking to the airport and, you know, a group of young girls, you know, 15, 16, scream, like blood-curdling screams, and then running towards me. And I didn't know how to handle that. I was just like, this is not fun. I guess I can't wait at the gate. I have to go wait in some stupid room. No, really. I mean, that's – I didn't like it.
Well, that also sounds like the New Yorker in you. Like, hey, I'm just a guy. I'm not just – can't we just – everything is all fine.
Yeah, can we just be cool here? Yeah. And now it's worse with all the social media. You're always on camera now.
Do you like it? Are you on social media much?
No. I tried. I think it's amazing. I really do. And I really appreciate, like, different people's Instagrams. But I'm not, because I find it first of all, I find it really time-consuming to do it correctly or do it, like, in a way that I would want to do it.
Yeah.
It's just too much time, frankly, between work and having a five-year-old daughter. But also, I tried once to actually – in my head, I thought it was a cool way to, like, talk to fans and kind of be, hey, let's break down this thing and let's just chat and, you know, we'll, and I got into it with a guy once over over Trump, actually, about 5 years ago or something. This was when, I guess 4 years ago, when Obama was already our sitting president.
Right.
And this guy.
And you wanted Trump in office immediately.
And Trump had made another comment about hiring the best people, his goons, to go, you know, find
right.
the proof that he wasn't a legal
citizen. Oh, right.
Citizen,
yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
Again,
right.
even though he was our sitting president for over 4 years. So I said something to the effect, and, you know, which I maybe now I realize I shouldn't have, about this is obviously a bigot. I mean, this is bigotry. This isn't, you know, plain and simple. And this guy, you know, a nice guy in the Midwest, took issue with what I said, and we started to have a back and forth, a dialogue, and through Twitter, I think it was, yeah. And at some point, I just realized, you know what? I'm never going to change this person's mind. And this is like an exercise that I will never do again, basically. I didn't see the point of it. So I said something. I ended my exchange with him saying, this is what I love about this country. You and I could respectfully disagree, and I wish you well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's social media, unfortunately, you know, particularly when you're hitting topics like politics or religion or any of the big ticket items, they need to be conversations, and social media does not foster conversations. Social media fosters emotional outbursts because they're so short that you can't really – and you're also
– protected by anonymity for the most
part. Totally protected by anonymity. That is the worst.
I mean, it's so true, and everyone knows this. Like, you would never say half the things you say if you were sitting across from the person.
No.
And it's just not for me.
It's shit you shout when you're in your car. When you're alone and you yes. know that no one's going to hear you,
yes.
you can say the worst things about everyone yes. around you in traffic, but you don't mean it and you don't want them to hear it. But that's kind of what social media has become now. It's shouting in traffic.
Yeah.
That's all it
is. And everyone's a critic.
Everyone has an opinion and everyone's a hole poker and everyone, you know, it's fine. I think the good things about it do outweigh the bad things, uh-huh. but I would really love to see what the psychological and sociological effects are of people interfacing with machines and social media in 20 years, 30 years. Like, what does that do to a generation of brains?
I'm frankly really concerned for my daughter. I mean, she's 5. She can easily navigate any device
yeah.
you put in front of her. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm looking at these, as I said, 15, 16-year-olds, and you know, sitting on a couch and not speaking to each other.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering what it's going to be like in 10 years when she's 15. You know?
Well, hopefully the technology will be more integrated into the way that
it'll just be a chip in her eye.
Yeah, and so it'll look like she's looking at you,
so
but
she'll
just
look,
past
she'll
you.
She'll be nodding,
yeah.
and really she's
but not
having,
talking to you.
Right.
Yeah, she's talking
well,
to someone
be
else.
Well, that'll be better, I guess. Yeah.
I just did a radio show, and the host, Steve Jones, showed me a video. He was in a restaurant. And everyone in the restaurant was sitting across from each other just on their device. And he was like, and I was no better. I was filming the whole thing. Like, not one person was looking at one another. Right. People just don't. People are more put off by silence and uncomfortable social interaction. They would rather just put their fucking face in their phone.
I mean, I'm really interested in what the studies are going to be in 20 years. I also think, I really do think, over time, our physiology is going to change. There's going to be a different way we walk and carry ourselves because everyone's spending so much time looking down at a different angle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a complete.
If they don't integrate the technology into, like, if there is not integrated wearable technology, then yeah, I think we'll involve like a set of throat eyes, so you could just like constantly be looking down.
I think,
and looking ahead.
I really do. I think we're going to change physiologically.
Well, there's so many things that are. You know, like driverless cars, you know, are going to continue to allow people to be in their devices. But, you know, I do think.
Will you be in a driverless car?
Boy, I don't know. And I love
There's
technology
no way
so
I
much,
be,
but I just feel
I
like.
I do too. I'm a tech geek. But
at the end of the day, it's still a machine.
I will never let someone drive my car for me.
I mean, my most frustrating interactions are with devices. And, you know, for no reason when your phone just crashes and it's like, okay, well, that was a low stakes thing. I was just writing an email.
right.
Not running over, you know, a bunch of people. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that.
I'm amazed about the predictions of how popular people think that's
I know, but then we're just going to end up being like those old people who wouldn't get on a train. They were like, it's the devil's carriage. What? 20 miles an hour. Who needs to get anywhere that fast?
No. I'm all for like a driverless train because there's a track. It's a predetermined kind of destination. And
yeah.
There's no oncoming traffic.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm not doing it.
Flying cars are the one thing I'm glad that didn't manifest.
Flying cars.
They're the worst idea ever. Just the worst. Hunks of car dropping out of the sky because people are texting. I mean, it's just everything about it. Everything about it's horrifying. I want to hear about it. So, because you have a 5 do you have any other kids?
A 5-year-old daughter.
Because I'm getting married in August. And
congrats.
Thank you. And we are planning to have kids next year. And then I will be 45 next year when I have a kid. So, was it something that you thought, oh, I don't think I'm ever going to do this? And then you got to a point where you felt like, now I feel like maybe I want to do this.
Nope. I always wanted to do it. I wasn't ready mm-hmm. until I was ready. And coincidentally, I found the right person. But I've always wanted to be a dad. Always. And you will see, it is the greatest. I think it can't be beat. Also, I feel like it came at a right time in my life and probably my career in that I think I'd become a little hardened. I think the longer you're a bachelor and the longer, for me at least, you're in this industry, you can become a little jaded, a little cynical, a little hardened. And having a baby, you know, you just find yourself, you're actually laughing every day. So you just can't. Be that cynical as much, you know, because it's just so ridiculous how the things they do is just
that's good.
So fun.
I'm always glad to hear that. I always ask because, you know, like my mom, by the time my mom was my age, I was like 20.
No, I know.
And so
no,
it's sort of a
same
strange,
with me. My parents were
thing.
22, you know, so yeah, I mean, I became a dad when. See, when I was 44.
Right.
So, first of all, stretch. You got to stretch. You know, you got to take care of yourself because they get heavy and they're still going to want to be carried and jump on you. And I mean, it's the real deal.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I don't want to be like Tony Randall dad, like, you know. I don't want to be like crazy old, like, where is that goddamn baby? I mean, I don't know if he was like that, but I just mean like you don't want to be like old guy dad. Like, I still want to be, you know,
active.
You still want to be active, yeah. But I do know there will be a point where, you know, when if I show up at like a parent teacher conference, I'm like, oh, are you the grandpa? No,
no, that's not gonna happen.
I hope not.
No.
I feel like our generation looks younger than our parents did at our age, but that could also be perspective. Don't you think? I feel like people who are our age.
I got, I see some of my peers and they look their age.
Well, that's just not taking care of yourself.
You've got good genes.
Well, I feel like
good genes.
But because you look great too.
Oh,
you look fantastic. You got that full head of hair. He's like. You easily could pass for 36, I think. Easily 36.
I think it's pushing it, but I appreciate it. I'll take it.
But I, you know, like that idea when we were younger of what a guy in his mid-40s looked was a lot different. I feel like it was a little – people grew up quicker when we were growing up.
I think you're probably right. I think there are – I think – well, first of all, we're all – in general, we're all marrying later.
Right.
You know, we're partnering up much later and – you're right. I think people try to take a little better care of themselves maybe than a couple of generations back. So,
all you need is a raw steak and some whiskey and a pack of cigarettes. I don't know if that's really...
Yeah, you know, I still, you know, well, I grew up with, you know, you finish everything on your plate. You know, just food and the portions here in this country are so ridiculous. Do you know what I mean?
I could not take my grandfather to the Cheesecake Factory. Be like, well, you gotta finish. Oh, I'm gonna die.
Right. The portions are incredible. And they're insane. So I still have to catch myself sometimes when I'm out to eat. Like, you know, why am I doing this? I'm actually full. And there's something about like that parental guilt in the back of that voice in the back. Finish your plate.
Well, yeah, well, especially because my parents weren't so much like that, but my grandparents, you know, grew up during the Great Depression, and right. So you know, and so there was very much you need to. This is going to go to waste, right. You know. Or if you don't, there are starving children. Can I mail this to them? You know, like there was no way around it with my dad's grandfather. But yeah, I think my parents' generation rebelled a little bit, and then our generation. I don't know why you need like 3 or 4 chicken breasts in a meal. At Cheesecake Factory.
That's crazy.
It's like two. It's like a couple on a pile of mashed potatoes. It's an insane.
Yeah, I mean the recommended protein amount is a piece of meat or fish the size of your fist. Like that's it. That's all you should.
What's
eat.
The recommended pizza amount?
I think that's 3 boxes.
It's 3 boxes three of pizza. Boxes. Yeah,
I love pizza. I love pizza.
Well, of course, Chicago. You must
yeah,
have
Chicago. And
do you
York,
like the pie or do you like the thing?
No, I like both. I like you know, there's I like the stuffed spinach pizza.
Interesting.
It's real good.
Where's that?
Well, it used to be at a place called Carmen's
mm-hmm.
in Evanston.
Okay,
where's you know near close to Northwestern.
Yeah,
other places do it, but that was the best. The Carmen's stuffed spinach.
Where's good pizza in L.A.?
I don't know. Oh, John and Vinny's.
Where's that?
John and Vinny's on Fairfax.
Never been there.
Yeah. That's a fantastic place, fantastic restaurant, great Italian food, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
I had no idea.
Really?
Yeah.
It's the best place in town.
Do you know this, Kyle?
I'm familiar with it.
That means you haven't been there, but you've heard of it? It's phenomenal.
I still want to explore this idea that you knew each other in second grade, and somehow you have complementary careers.
So you're talking about Ina my publicist.
Because Ina represents a lot of people
friend.
Who've been on the podcast.
Yeah, and she's awesome. So Ina and I were in the second grade together, and she was always – at that time, she was taller than I was because I was a child. And
early bloomer? You sprout up right away? Yeah.
And then I went away to school and in Chicago, and we kind of – you know, she went her – you know, to her – college and her career, and I went to mine. And I remember when I was on a photo shoot, the cast of Friends and the cast of ER were doing some kind of photo shoot, I think for Vanity Fair or something. Both casts were doing some big photo shoot. And I look across the room, and I think you were working with Anthony Edwards. That's right. And I look across the room, and I was like, no. That, and I was like, Ina? And she's like, David, I'm like, what the heck? And I said, well, we have to, can we work together too? I mean, this is awesome. So we've been working together since.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's amazing awesome. That I would like to think that maybe I would recognize someone that I went to second grade with.
She hasn't changed much. She hasn't changed much since the second or third grade. So
what were you like in second grade?
I don't remember what I was like in second grade. I remember I had problems in like fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. I was like hyperactive and kind of a troublemaker, like class clown / asshole. You know what I mean? I really was. I got into a lot of fights. I was almost expelled several times.
What?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, bathroom fights.
I never would have. I was like, oh, David Schwimmer, he seems like a guy who was always in the library. Enjoying books.
I did enjoy the library. Not then, but in college, I liked the library. I was not a sweet kid.
Did theater channel all that energy?
No, I mean, I was doing a lot of sports at the time, so that helped. I just had a lot of like manic energy. So I was doing every sport I could. And then junior high, I went to Paul Revere Junior High and continued that. And then I didn't really get into theater or acting until high school when they made me choose between baseball practice and – because I love baseball. I played a lot. They made me choose. I couldn't do rehearsal and practice. Right? Because you only could do so much after school, right? And I went where the girls were. So, to be honest, I mean, that's where all my energy went.
Okay.
To trying to be with girls.
Did it
unsuccessfully
work?
For the
it
most
didn't
part.
Work. It didn't
no.
work. No.
No. Not, well, I had a girlfriend in high school, but not till I was my junior. So,
and then in college, you studied theater in college.
Yeah, yeah, and girls.
And you studied girls in college. Yes. I tried. I went to all boys school, all boys high school. So when I went to college, I was
what school?
It was a school in L.A. I moved out here my senior of high school. It's called Loyola.
Oh right, okay.
Yeah, I went to another all boys school back east, and then yeah, and it was like being around girls was so overwhelming that I couldn't focus. It was almost not good because I was so overwhelmed by it, right. And I didn't know how to socialize with them. Part of that was because I was weird. But not all girls like playing D&D and computers, and, you know, at least not at that time.
Right.
Now
right.
It's very accepted.
Right. Now it's chic.
Now it's very chic. Yeah. Yeah, now you're dumb if you don't do those things.
That's right. D&D parties.
But at the little D&D makeout sesh, you know, if you roll and then you get touch a boob or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was just a different, yeah, it was so different. And now I just feel like it's so much a part of the culture that it's, you know, it's kind of nice. Is your daughter into, what is she into?
Well, she's in preschool. So actually her last day was today.
She got expelled for fighting in the bathroom.
Say again?
She got expelled for fighting in the bathroom.
No, she's a good kid. She's into a lot of art. She likes making things and building things, so she loves that. She also loves performing, so I might be in trouble. She really likes putting on shows. You know, there was a good 4-month period where she and all the girls in her class were nonstop Let It Go, you know, right? It was just nonstop doing every day was – and I had gotten her this little cheap karaoke machine where it takes DVDs or CDs and stuff. So she was performing Let It Go nonstop, and also but putting on shows, not just that, like she would be really interested in the whole – setting up the whole stage. So she would be dimming the lights.
Oh, wow.
Like putting me exactly where I should sit.
She's producing.
She's producing, mm-hmm. directing. She's a triple threat.
Yeah.
So she was doing that for a while. And The Lion King, she's really big on. That was the first show, actually, we took her to see was The Lion King when she was 4. I was a little worried because it's like 3 hours long.
Right.
But she sat there on like riveted for
she
3 hours.
She might
be
a performer.
Yeah,
she might could be a producer performer.
And also, I'm teaching her chess, so that's a little geek in there.
You play?
Yeah, I love chess.
I play.
I'm playing 4 games right now.
Are you serious?
Yeah, are you kidding?
I played competitive chess in school.
I did too. I mean, when I was, I don't want to brag, but I will. I mean, no, when I was 11 or 12, I won LA, whatever it was, LA County. You know, for my age bracket, I won first place.
You might
place.
Be sitting across from the Memphis City Junior High Chess Championship.
What?
I don't want
to. We might have to get on this. What's your favorite app? What's the app you use?
You know, I just I had downloaded some basic low end chess program for the phone, and I actually found a lot of the problem that I was having playing now was that it was so much mental energy when I was playing in school competitively that I found that it hasn't been as fun for me to play now because every time I stare at a chessboard, I'm trying to think 7 moves ahead.
Right.
And it just like the leisurely activity of engaging with some, you know. So I've been trying to slowly kind of get back into it. So it was just a very basic, you know, like whatever had the highest rating chess program on the App Store,
right?
And just kind of playing against the computer.
Yeah, I hadn't played in like a decade or something, and then one of the cast members on OJ had it on his phone. And I said, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Playing chess." And I go, "What? Let's do this." We had so much downtime in the courtroom sometimes, so that we started playing. Then I've still got like 2 games with 2 cast members from OJ, and I've got Michael Gladys. You know, is I've got a game. He's kicking my ass right now in another game.
Was the rest of that fun, by the way?
Yeah. Yeah, it was very cool.
What a strange...
It was great. That was a great experience, really.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was... and the fact that it became like a water cooler show.
It was a thing. It became a thing.
Although in another week or 2, everyone's going to go, what? What was the thing? What was the... You know what I mean? That's how people just... Yeah.
Well, because we're all distracted all the time. Because there's a lot of good entertainment right now, but there's just so much of it.
Yeah.
We're in the Cheesecake Factory of entertainment.
It's impossible
to keep up on anything. Wait a minute.
Whoa.
Hang on a second. Whoa.
Well, I'm sure you'll kick my ass in a chess game, but we should.
No, I would love to. What app do you?
It's Chess Time.
Chess Time.
Yeah, I'll show you after.
Chess Time sounds like a.
I know.
It sounds like a video series your mom would have seen on TV in the 80s. Sweetie, I got you Chess Time because I know you love chess. You can invite some of your lady friends though. Mom, they don't play. You know, like at least not in my school. They didn't. Were you in chess club in school?
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole time?
No, I mean, like a year or two in high school, I think, or it could have been junior high. Could have been because I played when I was young. I started when I was like 9 or 10. You know, there were a couple of things I was just talking about this recently where I realized there were a few games that I started to play with my dad as a young man that. I realize looking back on it now that I'm a parent, like I'm so glad he didn't let me win. Do you know what I
yeah,
mean? Like,
absolutely.
I mean, it was never cruel. It was just he played for real, you know, and I'm really glad that he kept both chess and ping pong are the two things, and tennis were the three things that my dad and I would play, and I just couldn't beat him. Like for years, I just could not beat him. And he was always very encouraging and everything, and finally, the day came when I could beat him at each of those things, not all at the same time, obviously. And it was just really meaningful in a way that I don't really.
Well, you can't learn if someone lets you win.
But there's a fine line because I'm teaching my daughter now, and there's a fine line in playing games with the kid. And I guess he was able. They did it, my parents with us, where you want to keep it from being totally. Discouraging,
right?
Totally.
We don't want to obliterate them.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, how many times? For how many years can you just get punished? You know.
But there's also a psychological thing too of and breaking through that barrier because your parents are these like omnipotent authority beings,
right.
And there is kind of a weird thing where you think you can't. It's like oh, because you get in your head about it. But when you actually break through that thing, then that's a huge moment.
It is. It's profound.
It really is. And I think there's so much emphasis now on like, we got to let everyone think they can win. And it's like, well, I don't know if that's really going to help them later in life. Like, you don't want to embarrass them.
Right.
But, you know, you learn by falling down. You learn by – that's how you get motivated.
Right.
I don't know. I hope – you feel like you know what you're doing at this point with parenting?
Yeah, and you will too.
Everyone.
It comes so intuitively. Yeah, we're all going to make mistakes. I'm not saying I don't make mistakes. But, I mean, for the most part, you know, you know what to do.
I hope so. My fiance is amazing, so I just assume, like, I'll just go, yeah, what she did. Everything she said. That's right. Listen to your mother. Daddy's busy. Following his dreams.
When are you getting married?
August.
Where do you know where?
We're getting married locally. Yeah, we're getting married
cool.
In Los Angeles.
Nice.
Yeah. It just seemed like we didn't want to create work for people.
Right, right.
Like, come to our wedding. It's dolphin themed, so everyone's got to dress like a, you know, like whatever. You know, we just want it to be really easy and simple.
Great.
Short ceremony.
Nice.
Did you get married in LA or near Chicago?
No, we got married, we got legally married in New York, and then we had our wedding in London.
Oh,
my wife's nice. British. So.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Was it a big to-do?
I don't know. I mean, it wasn't like a giant to do, but it was, I don't know, about 150, 170 people or something.
Nice.
We knew, you know, our criteria for who, you know, who was there was just like, I didn't want to have to feel like I had to invite uncle, whatever,
right.
You know, who I haven't seen in 20 years. You know, I wanted... you know, although the parents, of course, are involved and, you know, they say, you got to invite the thing. like, do I?
When are we going to stop calling him the thing?
Like, do I? Can't we just have another party in New York for those? For, yeah. I don't know. I mean, everyone has their own thing. But we did a best friend of mine married us. One of my best friends married us, which was great. So we just kind of made up our own.
That's nice.
Our vows, and it was fun. It was chill and silly and fun.
I just sort of feel like the wedding invitation list is almost like Minesweeper, where you're like, oh, I invited this person. Oh, I got to invite all these people now. Oh, I got to invite all these people now. Like, it's a never-ending. Right. Like, where's the cutoff?
Did you do the tables, like, where people are – did you do the seating yet?
We haven't done this – I don't think we've done the seating yet.
Oh, man, that is not fun.
Weddings make people fucking bananas. Like, and not – I don't mean my fiance or like everyone's pretty chill on our side, but I mean like other people.
Right, right.
I didn't get invited yet. Did you get it? Is this thing? Why is that to table? Like, I don't know. It just feels like such a weird thing. But I guess maybe it's just because everyone wants to feel like, you know,
they have a part or they have a say in it.
Yeah,
or something. Yeah.
But did you do it for? You did it just for you guys,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. Yeah. We invited a lot of people.
But that's
and it wasn't even our
I think we invited like 600. Well, I'm sure they're all looking forward to coming now.
I think like 600, yeah. I don't know if 600 people are coming.
Plus dates?
No. Oh. No.
Oh, just 600.
Yeah, just 600. That's right. It's like 5 or 6, like 5 or 6. Oh. Well, she has a big family and I, you know, like I have family, a lot of friends, and a lot of, you know,
and it's bring your own beer.
It's bring your own chair, bring your own entree, bring your own music.
Are you better work? Or you're going to be working a long time?
It's crazy. I think it'll be fine.
I'm sure it'll be a blast.
But we have a few minutes left, so I just want to make sure that we get to talk about Feed the Beast. A
sure,
because I haven't. I feel like. I know AMC has some sort of a bank of shows that I can go in and watch, but I don't know where it is. So I have not seen Feed the Beast
yet. That's totally fine.
Please, please. But it looks foodie.
It's a 1-hour drama, 10 episodes. Clyde Phillips, who created – or you know, who was the showrunner on Dexter and Nurse Jackie is
those are very good shows.
He's great. He's so talented. And it's a – I think it's a unique – show and the tone of it is really unique. It's a drama, but there's dark comedy, violent crime, and as you say, cooking and a little magic realism. So I think it's really unusual, and that's why I was drawn to it. I thought, well, I don't know if we're going to be able to pull this off, but if we do, then it's going to be cool. I still don't know if we pulled it off, but, by the way. You know, in brief, I play an alcoholic sommelier who is a widower and raising a 10-year-old mixed-race son because my wife was killed in a hit-and-run a year prior to when the show starts. And my best friend, played by Jim Sturgis, is a very talented chef who just gets released from prison. And you know, he basically convinces me to rekindle the dream we had a long time ago of building the restaurant of our dreams in the Bronx. So it's it's these two childhood friends who have no other family really to speak of besides themselves and of course my son, trying to put back the pieces of their lives through this act of creation of this restaurant.
And so is it the kind of thing where you're –
Thank you, by the way. Thank you for not falling asleep during that.
I did not fall asleep during that.
I appreciate it.
No, of course. That would be terrible.
Can you imagine, Chris?
What?
Oh, I'm sorry. Dude.
What?
I'm finished. So.
Oh, yeah. Feed the Animals is on BBC.
Yeah, BBC.
It's on BBC. No, but I honestly – I saw the poster for it and the art for it's super cool. And you guys are on the subway. And I just there's a foodie thing and it feels like there's a New York thing. But I didn't know exactly what the show was about.
That's basically the setup for it.
I think it's kind of a nice place to be too, where you go, you know, this looks interesting. I think I'll do this thing. I mean, that's a pretty amazing place. When you finished Friends, did you think, well, I don't know when I want to work? Like, were you worried about work or at all?
Well, look, I mean, the greatest gift of that show was also the financial freedom.
Of course.
So I wasn't worried about work, which is a huge blessing as an actor. And really, I just wanted to do other things. I wanted to direct. I spent a big chunk of time doing theater and directing.
You directed, yeah.
Movies some TV pilots and other things, and directing and acting in theater. I just wanted to kind of mix it up, change it up, and get back to doing more theater and directing. So I took a big chunk of time focused on that. After playing the same guy for 10 years, the last thing I wanted to do was jump into another series commitment.
Of course.
So only now, after 12 years, and because it shoots in New York, and because I thought this show and this character was so unique and frankly challenging, I thought, yeah, this I'm willing to jump.
Are you directing anything at the moment?
No. I'm attached to direct a play off-Broadway at Playwrights Horizons, but it depends on if the show gets picked up and what the schedule is. So.
Right. It's kind of funny. It kind of goes back to the same thing. It's like, oh,
I'd love to do it, guys, but...
My show got picked up. I'm sorry, you guys. You guys will be fine. You guys will be fine. It was really great meeting you, and I would love to play chess.
Let's do it.
I absolutely will. I'm going to get chess time on the thing.
I'll give you my name, my
username.
Yeah, you have to create it.
Of course, you have to create an account.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Good
Thank
to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. Feed the Beast. What is the information?
I don't know.
I probably have it.
June 5th, it premieres on AMC. And then after June 5th, it'll be every Tuesday night on AMC.
All right. I was actually pulling that up. You just say, June 5th, and then every Tuesday on AMC.
Yeah, they're going to premiere it after the second episode of Preacher, I guess.
Excellent, which is great. I don't know if you've seen.
Yeah. I just watched the premiere. Yeah.
Super, super fun. David Schwimmer, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.